Hi everyone, this is Evidence AGI and I am Elian Kazi, one of the editors in the journal. Today we will be discussing the new guidelines that came out about managing pregnant people with IBD with our fellow from NYU, our IBD fellow from NYU, Dr. Basantham Chaudhary. And this is a summary that will be issued soon in EBGI in November 2025, and it is published online in multiple journals. This is a particularly really exciting topic, especially that there are few new additions to the guidelines, things that we will discuss in this podcast, and obviously it's very relevant to all of us. So welcome back, Dr. Chaudhary.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And as always, actually, can you let us know why this topic is important for our listeners, how it can help our patients specifically?
Of course. Well, of course, many of our patients with IBD that we take care of are people of childbearing age. And this is a topic that's very important to them. Even often before we bring it up, they've been thinking about, you know, how does IBD impact their fertility, their safety during pregnancy? What about medication safety? So this is a topic that comes up all the time in clinical practice, and it's a very robust, thorough guideline. It was made by the Helmsley-Piano Expert Global Consensus Group. They used the GRADE methodology to assess the quality of evidence and make their recommendations. And then for data that was not suitable for GRADE, they used the RAND appropriateness method to achieve expert consensus. It is very exciting. There's a lot of new topics that, you know, we'll focus on.
Awesome. Yeah. Let's start. First one, biologics. What does the new... Actually, I don't want to say it's a new guideline. It's the first guideline. So there hasn't really been any guidance on this topic until today. And we are very, very grateful to all of the authors and the patient advocates, the GI doctors, the OBGYN, everyone who really contributed to this amazing document. So biologics, what can we do about these?
Right. So in prior, you know, statements, guidelines did not say much about vedolizumab or IL-23 inhibitors, of course, because there was less data about these medications. The new recommendation in this statement is that it was really the emphasis that all biologics, including IL-23s and vedolizumab, can be recommended to be continued during pregnancy. Really, the key thing during pregnancy is disease control and trying to achieve remission even before pregnancy, because we know that active IBD increases risks to both the mom and the baby during the pregnancy. So the goal really is disease remission.
What does the document or the new guideline or these guidelines mention about small molecules? We have the JAK inhibitor and the S1P ones.
That's always the question, because we know that small molecule inhibitors can cross the placenta even in the first trimester through passive diffusion is the thought, unlike biologics that undergo antibody-mediated transfer later on. First trimester, we know, is where organogenesis happens, so there's always a risk of increased not teratogenicity, birth defects. So because, you know, there is limited data on S1P, so currently there's no, we recommend stopping before pregnancy, and this was one of their expert consensus statements. And then there are concerns with JAK inhibitors. There's teratogenicity in animal studies, but again, human studies are quite limited. So of course, unless there's not a safe or effective alternative therapy for the maternal health of the adult patient, then these can be continued. But generally, the recommendation is to stop before pregnancy.
And this is what really happens in practice, at least in my clinic, with most of our colleagues here at NYU. We do ask patients, you know, of childbearing age, are you planning on getting pregnant in the next 12 months? Understandably, things happen, things change, sometimes unexpectedly. But when these patients are ready for childbearing, we do kind of, you know, make some changes that hopefully can help patients and their offspring, hopefully down the road. But I do want to circle back again to something you said, and I really want to focus on that as well to all of our listeners, that the only thing that we really want to focus on with these patients is disease control, as you mentioned. As we know that this is the primary barrier or hurdle for actual fertility, and one of the main reason or causes for complications antenatally or postnatally as well. So yes, disease control is our priority, and most patients do well with our biologics. I know it might be a myth and it has been debunked, but just to kind of get back on it, are we changing schedules of biologics around delivery or doing any changes with delivery modes?
So for biologic, again, there's no recommendation that we should be stopping biologics around delivery. These should be continued, particularly throughout the third trimester. There has been data that stopping it, you know, by the third trimester leads to worse outcomes as well. In terms of delivery method, it's really, there's recommendations that women with active perianal disease should be considered for cesarean delivery. And then women with IBD with a prior ileal pouch anal anastomosis should consider cesarean delivery, although these are conditional recommendations.
Definitely. But yes, you're completely right. And to all of our listeners, be it providers or patients who can tune into these podcasts, please continue on your treatment. Having disease control is the best thing for everyone. And we don't do the scheduling of deliveries or scheduling of biologic treatment at specific date and time when it comes to the delivery phase. So continue on as you were, and we'll get to all of this together. Awesome. So now, congrats, you have a kid. Tell us a little bit about the guidance on lactation.
Yes. The guidance on lactation, it's pretty similar to the guidance on medications during pregnancy. So there is really thought to be very little IgG transfer of biologics across breast milk. And I recommend everyone take a look at the consensus statement because there's a great graphic there that shows you how little actually makes it to the breast milk. So we think that women can continue to breastfeed even remaining on biologics, but the expert statement actually states, again, women on small molecules should not breastfeed because of the transfer. Otherwise, the other, you know, I would say emphasis in this statement is the change to the rotavirus thought for vaccines for the baby. So in the past, there was concern about giving live vaccines to infants exposed to biologics in utero, but now based on both retrospective and prospective studies, they found that it can be given to infants exposed in utero. This is a vaccine that's given at around starting at 2 months of age. And for moms who are on small molecules, they should have cleared by then for sure. So we are now recommending that the live vaccine schedule, starting with the rotavirus vaccine, can proceed as scheduled in babies with mothers exposed to biologics.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you for these two clinical pearls, Dr. Chaudhary. I do want to talk a little bit about that specifically with our listeners. 2 points. One is that some of the items that, I mean, I know we're discussing mainly guidance and guidelines in this podcast in our summary, but we did put the two tables of results. We have the table one, which is the actual guidelines, and then table two are the guidance that comes from consensus. And as you mentioned, that whenever the evidence is not robust or lacking, this is where the consensus kind of has been written. Specifically when it comes to JAK inhibitor small molecules, for example, though we are really focusing on the guideline that these are established, this one, because it's a negative statement, is okay to be considered as a consensus, mainly because of the lack of evidence. Second point will be about the rotavirus. So when we utilize GRADE methodology, we are not looking at the benefit only, we're looking at the risk-benefit ratio and when the benefit outweighs the risk. So providing biologics to moms and then giving afterwards the vaccine for kids, preventing rotavirus is extremely important. It has more serious complications equally rather than not giving it. So yeah, the GRADE methodology really helps us in putting these statements together because it doesn't only factor one thing, it's everything. And then it's more about risk-benefit ratio so we can really move forward with our treatment plans or diagnostic plans anytime we're giving a recommendation through guidelines. Last point that I would like to discuss is baby aspirin. So aspirin 81 milligrams, where at the moment and with the data we have and the knowledge we have, the guidance we have, where does this fit in that patient's prenatal slash antenatal process?
Right. Yeah, no, this is an emphasis of these guidelines that I think is great. It's being used, you know, in the general population for the prevention of preeclampsia. So that's the idea, being given to women even without IBD who have certain risk factors, including advanced maternal age. IBD patients are at higher risk of preeclampsia, especially when they have active disease. So this is something that's always been a question because people have wondered, does aspirin increase the risk of flares during pregnancy? And I think it's something even in my personal experience has always been a question from the OB or MFM team, whether these patients should be put on aspirin if that would trigger a flare. So these guidelines state that they do recommend pregnant women with IBD take low-dose aspirin starting at 12 to 16 weeks of gestation to prevent preterm preeclampsia. In general, you will want to discontinue it by 36 or 37 weeks to reduce the risks of bleeding during the delivery.
Thank you, Dr. Chaudhary. This has been really exhaustive and a very good detailed summary. Any parting advice or thoughts?
No, I think that the main thing was that this hopefully can provide some more reassurance to a lot of our patients. I think that medication safety is definitely a top concern for many patients. So for patients on biologics, I think this provides a lot of reassurance.
Definitely, that is an important point for our patients and for our other providers. You know, feel free to use those consensus guidelines to create studies and additional data and evidence and move them from a consensus point to a guidance point. This can always be the what we mentioned as the further research is needed in the topic. Wonderful. Yeah. But thanks again for joining me today. For our listeners, please remember to subscribe to Evidence-Based GI on your favorite podcast platform. And please follow us on X, or formerly known as Twitter, at ACG_EBGI. Please look for our blast email that come out monthly with the new issue of EBGI. Thanks again, and have a good day.
Thanks so much. Bye.